Hi, so here I am with my better quarter because my other cat is still around, but this is the new one. I don't know what her public name is going to be yet. So just this is the bad ornery kitten right now. Okay. I also wanted to remind you guys to sign up if you haven't already for the Morin Academy's free newsletter, where you can get articles from our co-founders and reminders of upcoming courses that we're offering through the Morin Academy. But today I wanted to read to you about 20 minutes from a chapter I'm working on right now. I'm doing a new book. It's sort of building on my ideological possession book, and it's going to deal more explicitly with the religious, spiritual dimension of political ideology in our times. One of my big questions is, why do people, or how do people, get into such a psychological space that it is difficult for them to more or less reconsider their beliefs? Or why is it that they believe so strongly in political ideas that it does seem as though they are zealous religious believers? In 1951, future Nobel Prize-winning University of Chicago economist Milton Friedman used the term neoliberalism to define a resurgent faith in free market capitalism. He was aware that the Great Depression and FDR's New Deal programs had led Americans to lose their trust in laissez-faire economics and to believe that business was in need of a strong government to regulate it, control it, to employ people when necessary, and to support certain enterprises like farming with subsidies. The result of the FDR work programs, as we know today, was an incredible amount of public infrastructure that helped the American economy grow, but is now 90 years old and crumbling. In 1951, people were just beginning to reap the benefits of all those public works, and many of them could directly thank them for their family survival during the Great Depression. There was still a great deal of fear driven by the experience of the Depression and World War II. But this fear stood alongside a growing optimism born of surging prosperity, the Cleaver years. Because this had to do with people's past and future, their vision of what life was and what it could become, Milton Friedman knew he was dealing with feelings, not just facts. This is why he adopted explicitly religious language in his early writing on neoliberalism, instead of just sticking to the facts. He spoke of Americans who appreciated the New Deal programs as adopting a faith in collectivism. In the midst of the Cold War, Friedman could see a way to turn their feelings and break them away from their supposed false religion. So he painted social welfare programs and regulations on business with the same broad brush as the hated Soviet communism. Repeatedly speaking in terms of beliefs and faith, Friedman notably promoted himself as a kind of prophet. Collectivism, he intimated, was a misguided religious belief, while individualism and neoliberalism were the real deal. In his own words, quote, "Until a few years ago, there was a widespread, if naive, faith among even the intellectual classes that nationalization would replace production for profit with production for use. Whatever these catchwords may mean, that centralized planning would replace unplanned chaos with efficient coordination, that it was only necessary to give the state more power in order to solve the supposed paradox of poverty in the midst of plenty and to prevent the selfish interests from exploiting the working masses, and that because socialists favored peace and international amity, socialism would, in some unspecified way, further these goals. The experience of the last few years has shaken, if not shattered, these naive beliefs." He added, "We have a new faith to offer. It behooves us to make it clear to one and all what that faith is." Friedman had found a formula for a mild form of strong-arming. Everyone wants to feel like they understand events. No one wants to be naive. This rhetorical strategy perhaps worked with a few of the people who happened upon what he wrote, but Friedman would have to work a lot harder to get traction with the wider public. Almost 30 years later, in 1980, PBS ran a documentary series hosted by Milton Friedman called Free to Choose. It followed the arguments of his book, Capitalism and Freedom, 1962. The series was a vehicle for its author and his faith in free market, and it marked the beginning of a stronger push using mass media to change the culture in the direction of neoliberal economics and politics. Friedman was one of our first mass market multimedia public intellectuals in the realm of economics. Unlike many academics, he was a fierce advocate for what he believed and had learned to put how to put himself forward in an appealing way to communicate effectively with the general public. The series, the culmination of 3 decades of effort in promoting the neoliberal ideology, covered the argument for why political liberty and economic freedom went together, how the free market worked to make production efficient, lower costs, and get goods and services to where they were needed. He explained how government regulations inhibited this natural ordering of the marketplace, and how politics, in effect, sullied the impersonal process with ulterior motives, like using lobbying and campaign contributions to get government regulation unfavorable to competition. Friedman explained that the prevailing theory about what caused the Great Depression was that it was a failure of capitalism to operate of its own accord. Many people, saved by the government programs in FDR's New Deal, became convinced that the government needed to be involved not just in the money supply, but also in continual regulation of the market, as well as welfare spending. Now, with extraordinary access to the attentive general public through a taxpayer-subsidized PBS program, Friedman could, in effect, reflect back on his predictions, proclaim them correct, and publicize them. He explained his theory that the 1929 stock market crash and the Great Depression were caused by the recently created Federal Reserve's decision to throttle the monetary system by not supplying the money that it had on hand to ease anxieties during a bank run. He argued that Keynesian-inspired welfare spending did not cure the problem of poverty, but created waste and bloated government bureaucracies. It hampered economic growth by taking money from productive elements in society and sidelining it in less productive outlets. What was needed, he argued, was an unfettered market instead, one that would encourage economic growth and the creation of new and higher paying jobs. The free market would produce more equality among people than redistribution could. Although Friedman argued it was not possible to guarantee equality of anything, but only opportunity. Some inequality was a necessary ingredient in dynamic and growing economies. Such an economy would lift everybody up, though at different levels. In the same series, Friedman got into education policy, arguing for parental choice in education and the use of vouchers for privately run schools instead of government run schools. He argued against consumer protection laws. The market could better sort out which products were good for people and which were not. Whereas government attempts at regulation always favored some and not others for political reasons. Unions and government laws protecting workers were also not necessary, he argued. Market competition for the best workers would automatically raise wages and benefits, as well as raise the pool of talented labor. In the last 2 episodes of his PBS series, Friedman argued against the U.S. Federal Reserve printing more money in order to stimulate the economy. Like other free market thinkers, such as Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, Friedman was motivated by a certain kind of anti-conservative radicalism. This way of thinking about laissez-faire economics versus conservatism may seem counterintuitive, but that is only because at a certain point, Keynesians adopted the term liberal as their own, and U.S. conservatives dropped the term liberal to understand themselves. Thus, in the United States, conservative came to mean what in most other countries was liberal. Von Mises, a peer of Friedman and one of the leading lights of the neoliberal turn, explained in The Anti-Capitalist Mentality how antithetical his ideas were to true conservatism. Quote, "Conservatism is contrary to the very nature of human acting, but it has always been the cherished program of the many, of the inert, who dully resist every attempt to improve their own conditions, which the minority of the alert initiate. In employing the term reactionary, one mostly refers only to the aristocrats and priests who called their parties conservative. Yet the outstanding examples of the reactionary spirit were provided by other groups, by the guilds of artisans blocking entrance into their field to newcomers, by the farmers asking for tariff protection, subsidies, and parity prices, by the wage earners hostile to technological improvements and fostering feather bedding and similar practices, end quote. As Eugene McCaraher puts it, quote, lamenting that liberalism had been stolen and corrupted by Keynesian enthusiasts for activist government, Friedman continued to use the term because, in his view, conservatism was not a satisfactory alternative. Echoing von Mises, the belligerent Friedman maintained, just as the 19th century liberal was radical, so too must be his common heir, end quote. Given his rejection of the instinctive tendency of people towards stability and conservative ways of thinking and being, Friedman, perhaps more than anyone else, understood that the ultimate rhetorical trick would be to make people think that what is radicalism is actually conservative and traditional. Conversely, it would be a sea change to make them think that any longing for stability and control over their fate actually represented a destabilizing radical position. This revaluation of values was something Friedman was now in a position to accomplish. Friedman's message to the American public brought von Mises-style radicalism to them in a palatable format with a strong dose of anti-communism. He communicated an emotion-infused conviction that America was winning the Cold War because her capitalist economic system did not stifle competition and creativity. Since Soviet communism destroyed human freedom, the supposed opposite of communism, capitalism, would of course guarantee human freedom. The public support for the change in economic imaginaries Friedman proposed had begun to build in the 1950s during a time of increasing prosperity, the golden age of the head of household family exemplified by the Cleavers. By the 1980s, the public was much more receptive, especially as the U.S. began to move out of the latest recession and history headed towards the fall of the Berlin Wall. Friedman and other neoliberal advocates were not all wrong about the pernicious effects of big bureaucratic government. Government bureaucracies are often inefficient and do not always achieve their intended goals. Often they are politicized and used by various economic interests to favor their agendas over others. Bureaucracies can operate at cross purposes, and they can perpetuate problems like racial divisions that already exist. Competition can lead to new innovations and better results. Oftentimes, people do make better decisions about their needs and how to pursue them than the government would make, because they understand their own circumstances better than remote bureaucrats can. However, I hope I've made it clear that Friedman's ideas swung fairly dramatically in the opposite direction towards a radical reduction in government intervention in people's lives. His popularity was tied up with a moment in time, from the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union to the end of the Cold War and the seeming triumph of Western-style liberal democracy and capitalism. His ideas were couched in the mythic story of capitalism versus communism. These categories were equated with freedom versus unfreedom, good versus evil. He was proposing, rather explicitly, a secular religion. The popularity of neoliberal ideas such as those in Free to Choose rose as people thought more in terms of this mythic narrative as the defining one for their nation. It wasn't so much that neoliberal economics represented timeless truths, though it presented itself as doing just that. Rather, it represented the polar opposite of the despised atheistic communist failure. U.S. capitalism, freedom and God, good. USSR, communism, slavery and godlessness, bad. Ironically, both neoliberalism and collectivism were explicitly presented by Friedman as faiths, and he made no attempt to bring the Judeo-Christian God to bear on the side of capitalism. Indeed, Friedman was an agnostic, with very little interest in traditional religion. As his friend Reverend Robert Sirico said on Friedman's passing, quote, Milton Friedman was not an avowed advocate of the unity of economics and religious faith. We had our differences on questions of religion, to be sure, specifically on the notion that liberty needs to be oriented to truth in order to ensure its proper use. Friedman was a true Enlightenment disciple and feared that truth claims could lead to coercion, end quote. Any reference to real religion was, in a way, better not said, as those who heard Friedman's message and found it appealing could make that connection for themselves, if they so desired. This storyline that made free market capitalism the equivalent of Christian faith was so attractive partly because of America's pre-existing city-on-a-hill civil religion. It reflected America's notions about its providential place in world history, inspired by the ultimate battle of good versus evil conveyed in the Bible. It piggybacked on simple categories already in the ether that everyone knew and could understand. Most importantly, with all our attention focused on what we were not, godless communists who hated freedom and competition, we were free to not think about what we were turning into, godless materialists whose social organization, big business, big government, also impeded the freedom to choose. For instance, the freedom to choose to be a homemaker rather than to get a job. Filling in the blanks in order to square capitalism with Christianity is how the improbable combination of support for unfettered capitalism, which decimated rural life, split up families, and automated out of existence previously venerated professions, especially farming and the trades, and Christian moral conservatism, became such a powerful emotional force in American rhetoric. Logically, it never made a lot of sense. Emotionally, it made absolute sense, in the same way Stockholm syndrome allows prisoners to admire their captors. Eugene McCarahare's massive Enchantments of Mammon, How Capitalism Became the Religion of Modernity, has a special place for the Friedman faith in its discussion of what has come to be known as capitalist realism. A term coined by Mark Fisher, capitalist realism conveys the same sense of ineluctability and futility that political realism conveys. This is the way it is, and any attempt to change things is foolhardy. In the name of such realism, all objections are to cease, and any ideas for a different way of life are to be scoffed at. Quote, conveyed in a flippant rhetoric of historical determinism, inexorable, irresistible, irreversible. These and other auguries of market predestination were volleys in what David Graeber has called a war on the imagination, a blitzkrieg against utopian speculation, a mission to sabotage the capacity to even dream of a world beyond capitalism. Any pain caused by the current system was to be suffered as preferable to the pain inflicted by trying to resist it. Therefore, all the precarity, dislocation, and humiliation caused by automation and globalization, all the loss of wealth caused by reduced real wages and benefits and increasing costs of retooling are just what is normal, and we can only do worse. As McCarahare puts it, these assaults on the livelihood and dignity of workers have just been justified as painful but necessary steps on the interminable road of progress, guided by infallible market forces to which we owe homage and genuflection. Friedman's theory made people feel smarter. His realistic view of human nature asserted that every human being is motivated by self-interest, and to think otherwise was simply to be naive. It valorized the tendency people already have to be selfish, to not want to help others. In fact, the message was, you'll help others most effectively by focusing single-mindedly on helping yourself. It also appealed by treating the market as an autonomous force whose logic was objective and, if not unduly hindered, would act of its own accord to solve social problems as disparate as racism, poverty, poor education, and pollution. This meant that to solve our dilemmas, we only needed to concentrate on getting out of the market's way and seeking our own good. Perhaps most powerfully, Friedman's message appealed to those who wanted to be identified with good and not with evil. That is almost everyone. As Milton Friedman affirmed as far back as 1951, neoliberalism is a type of religion, or what Adam Kosko called a political theology. He writes, "In the neoliberal worldview, we live in a world full of isolated individuals who yearn to express their freedom through participation in market competition. And the best thing to do to set that up is policies that effectively create a world full of isolated individuals who yearn to express their freedom through participation in market competition." From this perspective, neoliberalism is arguably the most coherent and self-reinforcing political theology ever devised. Neoliberalism affirms that everyone is free to choose, morally free, and have only themselves to blame if they make a choice that is bad for their bottom line, destructive to themselves or others, or harmful to the environment. Smart people will make smart choices that are in their long-term self-interest. And if we all did this, we would have a good society. I hope you've enjoyed this reading of a part of my chapter on ideological strong-arming. The book should come out next year,